Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 floors above downtown Chicago on a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, a jokey time. We're going to talk about fashion faux pas, and we are also going to be talking about weird things that happen in each state. And it is Monday. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning to talk about the movies, review the new ones, and to talk about the weekend box office. And it is Monday, which means let's get to it. And let's see. Here is Eric. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Last week, we had a very brief interlude to review the new movies that came out last week, because we gave out our we revealed our top 15 favorite movies of 2018 so far. So I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about. Eric, I wanted to have you tell us about Three Identical Strangers.
Yeah, this is a film that premiered at Sundance this year. A documentary premiered at Sundance, and also played at Chicago Critics Film Festival. It's a true story. It kind of took place in the 1980s. Really came to prominence when a a young man went to visit a college, and all of a sudden people started calling him by a different name. And what he came to find out is that there was actually another man who had all of his identical features. Turns out he had a twin brother. And what started as an amazing, happy time in their lives was then complicated further when news came in that there was a third brother. Three identical triplets scattered across the United States and are now reunited. And it became a momentary sensation. They were the talk of talk shows. They kind of cameo in Desperately Seeking Susan, amongst all things, because Madonna, was a huge fan of the story. And then, the story, takes some rather shocking turns. The kind of things that we don't want to get too much into in this thing, but let's just say that their separation was not an accident. So this is one of these documentaries that comes along that it's one of these, you cannot believe that, truth is stranger than fiction, certainly, but it's a really kind of sinister kind of tale, what begins as kind of this, amazing, somewhat coincidence to these boys, and gives them a momentary, lack of fame. It then turns into, the situation where depression sets in, not exactly sure how to deal with this, this loss that they've had in their lives, and when they just begin to discover the truth, and their memories begin to become in clearer focus, they discover that there are some really kind of sinister forces that force them into this situation. It becomes this unbelievable story about identity and loss, and it's just amazing that something like this would happen in real life outside of, like a comic book movie, for Pete's sakes. It's a really, really well told story in the documentary. Gives you a lot more to think about than you can imagine when the thing finally started. It's really a pretty amazing story that deserves to be seen.
Okay. All right, Colin?
Yeah, this is a really compelling piece of work. You watch the first 20 minutes and you think, okay, that alone makes a fascinating documentary. And that's pretty much what Eric just described, like the first 15 or 20 minutes telling that story about how these three guys found each other. Like, that alone is a movie. You got a whole other hour or so after that so many things just unravel. And it's just, it's heartbreaking and fascinating. Stylistically, the movie isn't much to, call attention to itself. It's pretty straightforward, news footage, talking head interviews, just very standard stuff. But it doesn't matter because the story is so compelling. You're not even going to think about that probably. So this is definitely worth checking out, and it's still at the Music Box. And I think it's playing elsewhere as well. I didn't check on that, but I'm sure it's out there in other places because it's the kind of movie that just shouldn't just be playing at one theater. Just is kind of a did this win in our audience award, Eric, for documentary?
Yeah, certainly did.
Yeah, so it was definitely a crowd pleaser of sorts. Not a feel-good movie, but it's definitely one that people would love to go see and talk about when it's over. So,
all right,
definitely worth checking out.
Okay, good. And then, Colin, another documentary opened last week called Whitney. It's about Whitney Houston, and I know that you liked it because you included it in your top 15 films of 2018 so far. Tell us about Whitney.
Yeah, so this was directed by Kevin MacDonald, who also made the Bob Marley documentary a few years ago, among many other films he's done, both documentary and fiction. This is, again, another one pretty traditional in execution, as we hear from pretty much everyone who knew her. And, we see whole movies and everything from her early days singing in a choir to her, downfall and eventual death. And the film opens with her saying how she often has dreams of being chased by the devil, but she always gets away. And the film sort of examines that, eventually she couldn't run anymore and the chase got the better of her, which is what led to her public meltdown and her rocky at best marriage to Bobby Brown, who also appears in the film and takes very little in the way of responsibility for playing a big role in that, which is one of the more really interesting facets of the film. And that's kind of what makes this an interesting journey. Whitney Houston's music was something that I never really gravitated towards and never really thought much of it. Obviously there's a great vocal talent at work there. I would never deny that. But, Kevin MacDonald's, a talented enough filmmaker to sort of transcend that and take us on a journey of someone who, is going through that chase and, just kind of watching her just not being able to run away from her demons anymore and still have an air of mystery about it when it's over. This is definitely a movie worth checking out, whether you're a fan of Whitney Houston or not, because I'm not. But this was a really compelling, interesting documentary. So.
Okay. All right. So that's Whitney. Those were a couple of movies that we were going to catch up on from last week. And to remind people, I liked the Ant-Man sequel. Colin, you were okay with it, right?
Yeah, okay.
And Eric, you liked it?
I did, yeah.
Okay, so all three of us, I think I liked the Ant-Man movie the most of everybody. And so those were some of the stuff that we were catching up on from last week. All right, I understand that you guys did not see Hotel Transylvania 3.
I didn't see 1 or 2.
Me neither.
But see, I this is amazing to me that you guys, that I'm the only one who's seen all three of these movies. So this is the third one. It's called Hotel Transylvania 3, Summer Vacation. It was number one at the box office. We'll get to that a little bit later. These movies, despite the fact that Sandler's star has kind of fallen and, he's just doing Netflix stuff now for the most part, these movies have, all three of these movies have been pretty successful, correct, Eric?
Oh, yeah. No, very much so.
Yeah. This is the story. They go on a vacation because they want to get away from the hotel for a little while. So they surprise Drac with a vacation. It's a family voyage where they go off on a cruise ship. It's a monster cruise ship, and all the wacky characters from the previous movies are all on board. And all the goofy stuff that you would expect from these movies happens. You've got Andy Samberg, Selena Gomez, Kevin James, Fran Drescher, Steve Buscemi. David Spade, Jim Gaffigan. I mean, it's pretty impressive. Molly Shannon does a voice here as well. And it's about the family going away on this cruise, and Drac falls for one of the people on the boat. In fact, the captain of the boat. and it's about romance ensuing. And it's about how the daughter this time is put in a position to make sure that Drac stays on course as opposed to the other way around, because in the other movies it was always Dracula trying to keep Mavis in line. And that's the other, so it switches around here. It's more of the same. These movies are, I don't think they're particularly clever or particularly funny. I will say this though, the animation for all three of these movies is pretty sharp. I mean, these are well directed. The guy who's directed these has worked on some great animated shows in the past, like really really great animated shows in the past, including Dexter's Laboratory and Samurai Jack. He's a very 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 talented animator, and it's Genndy Tartakovsky is the director here, and he's a terrific and an inventive animator. So the animation here is never less than terrific. It's just that the scripts for all three of these movies don't really match the quality of the animation. So it's a beautiful thing to look at, and it's a fun thing to look at. There's a lot of great character design here, and some really imaginative ways of telling the story in terms of animation. But the story itself is, you know, it's there's like four screenwriters on it, and the characters are minimally memorable. They're not particularly strong. There's no emotion to it, so you're never really checked in emotionally in these movies. You don't care really what happens to the characters. There are some funny sight gags. There are some entertaining moments throughout. It's bright, it's cheery, it's quick. The kids in the theater that I saw it seemed to very enjoy it, which is the case for all three movies. All three movies, the audiences that I saw all three films with seemed to really, really enjoy them. So there's something to be said. Clearly, people like these movies a lot. That's why they've made three of them, and it made a lot of money over the weekend. It's a movie that, you know, it's fine. You know what I mean? It's just... it's just fine. You could do worse. Out there if you want to take your kids to it. I would if you haven't seen Incredibles 2, clearly that's the one that you don't see this before Incredibles 2, for God's sake. So anyway, that's Hotel Transylvania 3 Summer Vacation. All right, you guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Colin and Eric are going to hang on, and we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got more new movies to review, and then a little bit later on, Eric will stick around, and we'll talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's a Monday morning. We're getting our work week kicked off. My dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And the Monday morning movie reviews are continuing right now. If you would like to get a hold of us, talk or text, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected, though, is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. So, lots more stuff coming up. We're going to be talking about fashion faux pas and also some weird things that happen in each state, which we didn't get to last week. We want to get to it this week as well. So that's all coming up, and you can check us out right now on our Facebook page as well. So it's Monday morning. Monday morning movie reviews continue. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me each Monday to review all the new movies, and then we talk box office with Eric after that. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Colin, why don't you tell us about Westwood, punk icon activist.
All right, well, this is a documentary about a fashion designer, Vivian Westwood, and she and her partner, Malcolm McLaren, who was the manager of the New York Dolls and the Sex Pistols. They designed a lot of clothing together, a lot of fetishistic clothing in the 60s, and she's kind of responsible for a lot of the punk fashion at the time, that the Sex Pistols would wear, and, just basically starting that whole revolution. The movie, now she's older now, she's Dame Vivian Westwood. And as far as her activism, the movie touches on some of her work with Greenpeace and, anti-fracking demonstrations. So, she's still active in the fashion world, and she's still active as an activist.
But when it comes to being interviewed on camera, she's a very reluctant interview subject. So she is not one to want to delve too deeply or get into it at all, any of the stuff that she did back in the 70s, which is some stuff that I want to know more about. That's what kind of separates this from other documentaries about, you know, fashionistas or the fashion industry, because, you know, to be honest, anytime I hear, oh, it's a documentary about fashion, I tune out. It's just one of my least favorite, you know, subjects for a documentary, just based on what I've seen in the past on this subject. But you tell me that she started the whole sort of punk revolution. You got my attention. Tell me she's still an active, protester and activist. I'm also interested in hearing that. But this is a movie that, I don't think she wanted to make. Or she didn't want, the best, most interesting part of her story to be told. Instead, it just kind of touches on these things very briefly. But then it's back to the standard stuff that we see in other documentaries about the subject, backstage at fashion shows. Why is she a genius? And, she's designing clothes that nobody would wear in public, but, she's great. And, she's controversial and takes risks, and everyone's outraged by her and everything. And that's all well and good, but there's an interesting story to be told here, and some dots that are worth connecting to tell a bigger, greater story. But, there's a subject, but the main subject of the movie is keeping her mouth shut. And so we have kind of an empty film, an empty profile documentary that really just kind of sits there. And it's really too bad, because there's like I said, there's an interesting story to be told about Vivian Westwood. But this movie doesn't really can't tell it. So. Not recommended.
Okay, that's Westwood, punk icon and activist, playing again just at the Music Box. Music Box has a lot of documentaries going at this point.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they just got everything going on at the same time. They still have American Animals there, too.
Yeah, okay. Lots of stuff happening over at the Music Box, so there you go. All right. All right, Eric. Why don't you tell us about Shock and Awe?
Okay. Well, this is the latest film from Rob Reiner, which is a statement that might have meant something about 25 years ago. But this is a story that takes place just after the events of 9/11, as a newspaper organization known as Knight Ridder, which is a company that basically owns a number of newspapers and also has reporters working for them, began delving into what the American government was going to do with its war powers concerning the people that attacked us. Woody Harrelson and James Marsden play the two reporters on the case. Rob Reiner plays their editor. And the two of them begin working their sources, and within the first half hour of the movie have basically discovered that we have missed bin Laden in Afghanistan, and now the Bush administration is taking basically all of its strengths and everything it has at its disposal to get us into a war with Iraq. Now, history obviously has told us that most of this was BS, and that everyone there was trying to fit a narrative that they wanted to play out, which obviously led to the weapons of mass destruction fiasco and Mission Accomplished and all these these things and these sound bites that we remember from this period. And this is a potential gold mine for a film. We love stories about journalists. We love stories about them uncovering mysteries and scandals. Some of the great films of our lifetime have been about the profession of journalism. And here's a story that is not even doesn't even have to be so much about the pursuit of truth, but also about how major news organizations such as the New York Times, particularly New York Times, and the Washington Post, got it so wrong. And this is a movie that basically gets it all wrong in telling the story. I mean, you know, Rob Reiner, who, you know, has not really made a good film in, like I said, probably since The American President in 1995. And, you know, I mean, now, you know, God bless him. I love his politics. He's on the right side of everything that's going on in this country currently right now. But this movie plays out like a cinematic representation of his Twitter feed. You know, it's a lot of speechifying. It's, you know, it's barely 90 minutes long, which is seems a very short period of time to tell a story that has so many layers to it. You know, like I said, they uncover things rather quickly in this movie. And Knight Ridder, you know, as credited in the film, is, you know, basically the only ones that got this whole thing right. It just didn't seem like they had to put forth a lot of effort to get it right, because everything just comes to them seemingly so easily in the film. I forgot to mention that Tommy Lee Jones also plays a retired war hero and reporter who's actually wrote the book for We Were Soldiers. That's how we actually introduced to him in the movie, is him on the press tour for We Were Soldiers, the Mel Gibson film. And it just, you know, so nothing in this film works. I mean, Mila Jovovich plays Woody Harrelson's wife. There's a ridiculous scene where an hour into the movie, she suggests that he's going to get death threats and that the organization is going to come to get him, as if to introduce some sort of some phony suspense into the film. It does lead to the only scene in the movie that I like, though, is where they actually, the next morning, do get a death threat at the office, and they bring it into the office of Rob Reiner's editor, and he corrects the email. That's the only scene in the movie I liked. And the movie needed more of that kind of just reverence or your humor and stuff. This is a film that, I mean, it's hard to watch at times. I mean, it feels like a third-rate reporter, you know, on a first-rate story and getting it all wrong, and then the story just blows up in flames. It's really unfortunate, you know, especially considering that we're just coming off movies like The Post and Spotlight from a few years ago. These are movies that get the task of journalism right. This movie just seems to be, you know, a collection of scenes and then speeches, and, you know, throwing in Jessica Biel as a love interest in the middle of the movie for absolutely zero reason. No, this is bad.
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, like, really, really terrible. You were talking about speechifying every single scene. And Rob Reiner, who obviously plays the editor, is terrible in this movie. And it's just nothing but, it seems to me like, I don't know about you, Eric, but I think they got almost everything done in one take. It just totally feels that way, because the line readings are so stiff, especially Rob Reiner. Rob Reiner is clearly, you know, and again, as you said, God bless him. He's an outspoken guy in these times, and you know, so you know, politics. He's a smart guy politically, and he's making a lot of statements in real life. But this is not real life. This is supposed to be a movie. You're supposed to be telling a story and acting, and it's just speech after every one of his lines of dialogue has some sort of like message or speech or really heavy handedness. Every single line of dialogue that he has.
That's why I like that scene where he corrects the email, because he doesn't say a word.
Yeah, yeah.
He just uses his pen.
Yeah, and it's shockingly bad, no pun intended. I mean, mm-hmm. like, and it's a really, you know, a great cast. You got, you know, Woody Harrelson is fantastic, but he's given nothing to do. He seems bored. You know, it just seems like he just like, all right, I'll do this movie.
Yeah.
And that's what it feels like with everybody who's involved, all the talented people that are involved in this movie. And there are plenty of talented people involved in this movie. But it all seems like, you know, like, I think Richard Schiff is in the movie so that we can think of The West Wing.
Sure. That,
you know what I mean? That's what mm-hmm. it feels like. And, you know, and I don't know. I mean, you know, and Mila Jovovich's character is ridiculous. And the handling of her character is ridiculous. And it just, I mean, I watched the whole thing and I just couldn't believe it. And it, like you said, it's barely 90 minutes long. And it just pales in comparison to the really terrific films about journalism that we've had over the past few years. I mean, if you take a look at, like you mentioned, The Post and you mentioned Spotlight, I always mention Shattered Glass.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorites. And I mean, you know, and I mean, obviously the crown jewel is All the President's Men. And, you know, when you're watching a movie like this, when you're watching this movie specifically, whenever it kind of feels like it's going to draw comparison to All the President's Men, which it does.
Which it does,
it's embarrassing. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, no.
There's actually a moment in this movie where they're questioning this woman. The two of them are questioning this woman who's a high-up intelligence officer or whatnot. And the line of dialogue, she talks about how, you know, all the lies are coming, you know, from, and, you know, like, where's the secret war thing that they're talking about? And they go, you know, what building is it in? She goes, the one with the five sides.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, oh, I rolled my eyes
hard. It's ridiculous. And then the other thing about it, you mentioned, like, you know, like every time that they're interviewing a witness, how many credits are in there? What do you call it? The on-screen explanations as to who people are? Every scene, not only are they telling us where we are, but who they're talking to, but then they don't get specific.
At one point it just says U.S. intelligence official.
Exactly. That's like, why even have that up there?
Right.
And they do that like 6-7 times during the course of the movie. Like, unidentified witness. Like, what the hell are you
putting? They're still doing anonymous sources in the movie that's supposed to blow the lid off the story.
It's a terrible movie. It is a terrible movie. And you know, we got to take a break. When we come back, Eric, I want to talk a little bit about Rob Reiner.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you wanted to talk a little bit about him.
Yeah.
So looking back at this guy's career, because, you know, he's responsible for some great movies, but this is really, I mean, this is a terrible movie. Like a really, really, really terrible movie. And I wanted to like it. I really did. So hang on, okay, guys?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric Childress, Colin Suter are here. And that's Shock and Awe. It's available on video on demand. It's also in theaters, and it's really awful. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We got more movies to talk about and reviews, and we're going to talk a little bit about Rob Reiner and what the hell happened to him. All right. We'll do that right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everyone. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Monday morning. That means the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric and Colin. And before the break, Eric and I reviewed Rob Reiner's latest movie called Shock and Awe, and it's really, really terrible. Now, Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So, Eric, you wanted to talk a little bit about what the deal is with Rob Reiner. I'm looking at his IMDb page director credits right now. And you're right. He hasn't made a good movie since The American President.
Right.
And that was in 1995. So, I think he's a good filmmaker, not a great filmmaker. I love This Is Spinal Tap.
Mm-hmm.
I like The Sure Thing. I like Stand By Me. I like Princess Bride. I don't like When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
I like Misery. I like Few Good Men. North, the less spoken about that movie, the better.
Right.
And then American President, I love. In fact, that might be... Oh, no, Spinal Tap's my favorite, but right up there is The American President, which I just think is... That is like, you know, for people who always are complaining that I don't like romantic comedies, that's a beautiful movie.
It's a beautiful movie.
And it's really funny, and obviously Sorkin wrote it, and it's really well cast, and Annette Bening is luminous in it.
Yeah.
And I really adore that movie, but that's the last good movie he's made.
Yeah, and, you know, it's, you know, we've seen this phenomenon, you know, many times where, you know, there are directors that, you know, have fantastic runs earlier in their career, and then they get older, and it just, the it just drops off, you know, some more than others. And Rob Reiner has been one of those guys that, you know, between like 84 and 95 had quite a run, you know, no matter what you think of some of the movies in between.
Yeah.
You know, successful and even, you know, critically, it's quite the run. And, you know, watching Shock and Awe, about 20, 30 minutes into it, I'm thinking to myself, what the hell happened to this guy? And just kind of hit me, which ironically, you know, ties into this movie in that the one thing that he's been missing since 1995 are writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you think about that period in his career. I mean, what? He had two scripts by Aaron Sorkin.
Right.
Okay, he had three by William Goldman, two based on Stephen King novels, so he had great source material on top of that. You know, whatever you think about When Harry Met Sally, most people would say that's Nora Ephron's best work.
Right, right.
You know, This Is Spinal Tap, obviously he has the improv cast of the, you know, the century right there. So, you know, he didn't need a script. And really, I mean, the only sort of anomaly in that entire run is The Sure Thing, I suppose, you know, which is just, you know, just kind of works. So I don't know. I don't remember who wrote that movie, but you know, that just, it was just a really good script, and he had great, you know, people in front of the cameras. And since then, I mean, like, starting with like Ghost of Mississippi, I think that was what, 96, I think.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I'm with him on his politics. I'm with him where he wants to be, but it's just, he's not, he needs material.
Right.
He really needs a writer.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I think you're 100% correct in that. Colin, what do you think was his last good movie? Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. And it's funny, I was looking at the director, the writer credits for The Sure Thing, and it's the same guys who wrote Jack Frost and Like Father, Like Son.
Wow.
So, yeah, right. That's an anomaly. That is definitely an anomaly how that movie worked. A charming cast goes a long way.
Absolutely.
But that was a really good script, too. I think where it really starts to drop off is like, I mean, you know, Ghost of Mississippi is not a good movie, but I can tell what he was trying to do. He was trying to, you know, take the quick and easy route to, you know, being nominated for an Oscar by taking on that subject.
Right.
And it just didn't work. But then you got The Story of Us and Alex and Emma. I mean, 1999 to 2003, that's where it just really starts to, you know, go downhill. I think the last movie of his that I saw was Flipped in 2010, which was this kind of coming of age, like Wonder Years period piece kind of thing, that was, you know, based on a very popular, young adult novel. And it was just wall to wall narration, wall to wall voiceover. And it was just like, what the heck, man? I mean, you're right. It's like, it was, I mean, that's where he had a writer who just, you know, didn't know when to stop. Eric's assessment is definitely right on about this.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad because, you know, there was a time when he was making really, really great movies. And I think you're right, Eric. I think the problem is the writing.
Yeah. He is Gulf Sorkin. Like, Sorkin would have done something with Shock and Awe.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That, you know, there's no question about it. And it's not like the topic of Shock and Awe shouldn't be made into a movie, because it absolutely should.
Yeah.
And it should have been a very compelling movie along the same lines as, you know, those other great journalism movies that we've mentioned in the past. But it just, it's so flat and so, you know, ham-fisted. And, like, you know, within 3 minutes, you're like, okay, Rob, I got your politics. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now make a movie. We all know what your politics are. You've made that, you know, you've made that abundantly clear. But you know what? You know, if you want to make all these grandiose speeches, you got to make a movie as well. Like, you have to tell a compelling story. And
yeah, I mean, it's just the further irony that, you know, what you hear from journalists is that you don't want to rush the story.
Yeah.
You know, you want to make sure you have everything in place before you, you know, you,
right,
you get out there. Same as a lawyer, you want to get all the facts of the case out there before,
right,
you, you know, indict everyone. And this movie feels like, you know, someone got one source and didn't get a second source and then just wanted to put the story out there.
Yeah. No, it's right. It's really terrible. All right. Well, you guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right,
mm-hmm.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we got one more movie to review, and that's the big action movie Skyscraper with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. So we'll do that right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. What's happening? We are live 18 floors up at 303 Wacker here in the new digs on WGN. Here till 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad is going to call in and tell a joke in a jokey time. And we are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews with Colin and Eric. And Eric is going to hang out, and we're going to talk about the box office as well. All right, let's welcome back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Colin, tell us about Skyscraper.
All right. Well, as you said, this is the latest action film starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and here he plays a security expert who used to be a Marine, I think.
No, FBI. FBI.
FBI. Probably also a Marine at some point, maybe
it
even a Navy
matter.
SEAL, probably a karate teacher, a bodybuilder, and anything else that will make anything he does in this film seem plausible in any way. Doesn't matter. Anyway, he's in charge of finding these security flaws in what is now the tallest building in the world, which is, you know, very futuristic and has a lot of theme park potential as well. And it would be too arduous to explain why suddenly there's a big fire on one of the middle floors. But there's a big fire on one of the middle floors, and there's a good, big reason for that. And The Rock has to get back inside the building because he's not in it when that happens, to rescue his wife, played by Neve Campbell, and their two kids, who are a few floors above the fire, which is partly orchestrated by the owner. There's a lot of, Die Hard-esque plots going on here involving many men and women with guns who have nefarious motives for, either burning down this building or killing its owner. But basically, this is The Rock in a burning building trying to rescue his kids from guys with guns while trying not to fall down. That's what you expect to see from looking at the poster, which every time I look at the poster, it looks like a fake movie for a fake fake poster for a fake movie in another film. But this is the real thing, and it's about as innocuous and kind of forgettable as the poster would indicate. However, there are some moments where I got to say I kind of was on the edge of my seat. But I'm an easy target when it comes to filming, action scenes in skyscrapers where people are, hanging from the windows or hanging from a crane trying to get into the building or whatever. So some of it's well done. But then again, like I said, I'm an easy target for that. And so my palms were getting a little sweaty during some of it, even though I knew what I was watching was incredibly dumb. And it's just kind of, very forgettable summer popcorn entertainment. We've seen the Rock do this sort of thing hundreds of times. It's good to see Neve Campbell on screen again. And she does what she can here, but again, it's kind of the forgettable, the thankless wife role, even though she does kick butt a lot, because she also has had, experience in the FBI or the military or whatever.
Well, she's the one who was in the Marines.
Okay, so you have a better memory of this than I do.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe because I saw it Monday and you saw it Saturday or something. I don't know. But, so.
And she's also a surgeon. I just wanted to.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, she's right. And she speaks three languages. And, yeah. It doesn't matter. If there's a plot hole, these two characters can fill it. Don't worry.
But she can't fix her phone.
No.
Yeah, she can't. No, this is a dumb movie, but it's not without entertaining moments, when you don't have to think about the story too much. Like you said about Hotel Transylvania, you could do a lot worse. I guess you could do a lot worse than Skyscraper. I'd have to look and see what else is out there. But this is, this should not be anywhere near the top of, of your list of movies to see this summer. This is a, probably the 2.5-star review you're hearing here.
All right.
So, yeah.
All right. Eric?
Oh, I liked it a lot less than you did, Colin. And I am an easy mark when it comes to Die Hard on a blank type scenarios. But this is basically Die Hard on a Die Hard. And, it's not exactly fair to compare any movie to that film. But maybe not release your blatant copy on the 30th anniversary weekend of that actual movie. That being said, watching this movie, speaking of The Princess Bride, if any movie needed Fred Savage to jump in and just stop the narrative every 20 minutes and go, hold on, wait a minute, this is the one. Because this movie achieves levels of dumb I didn't even think were possible. Starting with exactly why the fire is being set, who is setting the fire, the entire plan regarding around setting a 220-story building on fire to get one little thing out of the building that's under lock and key that may or may not have copies of it. It just seems so incredibly ludicrous. It's amazing. And one of the big problems with this movie, yes, it has a number of set pieces where The Rock is climbing and running and then climbing back out again and jumping and running through flames and all these kind of things, is that this is a movie that every single time it, you know, it wants to have one of these set pieces, it's instantly going to McClane jumping off the roof. Like, there is no in-between. It's always going for that big moment. And the more times it does it, the not only the less believable it becomes, but the more boring it becomes. I mean, the first moment where, you know, he's trying to get on this giant crane so he can get back into the building, and I must have missed a shot or something where it says he couldn't take the elevator, but then decides to climb on the outside. Nick, was there a reason he couldn't take the elevator?
Yeah, the elevator was locked.
It was locked.
It was bolted. It was locked, and when the SWAT guys showed up, they had bolt cutters, and that's how they were able to get in. And but did you guys just not watch this
Nick
movie?
Nick definitely saw this movie later than we did. So I missed that moment, apparently. But anyway, so he's climbing on the whole outside, and this movie, you know, has this like this weird meta thing going on where, you know, it's like everyone in Hong Kong is outside watching everything that's going on in this building, like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's, you know, tightrope walking, you know, between it somewhere. And they're watching on a giant screen, and every time it cuts back to them, I'm just like, you know, so wait, now I'm watching the movie through the eyes of the people watching the movie in real time, and the movie. It's just like, I was getting so frustrated with that stuff. Like I said, the plot is so ridiculous. Like little stupid things in the movie, like his former friend that, you know, he works with that gets him the security job. Even he's got a moment early in the movie where he does like the little, what's called the little Mysterioso thing from Modern Romance, where he rolls his eyes and you go like, oh, well, he's clearly involved in something.
He knows nothing.
Yeah, he knows. You know, nothing. Exactly. Thank you, Colin. And by the end of this movie, I was so completely bored, which is a lot to say, given that the movie's only 93 minutes long. Someone's got to explain what the purpose of the House of Mirrors is on the 220th floor, except to just have a climax that, you know, thinks it's Lady from Shanghai, but it's not even Conan the Destroyer. This is a bad, bad movie.
Okay. Let me preface this by saying this is one of the dumbest movies I've ever seen. It is dumb. There's not one single moment in this movie that is even remotely plausible on this planet. But I had a good time. I thought a lot of the set pieces were well done. I too, like Colin, I am terrified of heights. So there were, you know, moments in this movie where I was kind of freaking out. There was silliness through every scene in the movie. There was something really silly happening. And for some reason, I enjoyed it. I like the fact that Nev Campbell had to walk across a really thin 2x4 while The Rock was holding up the bridge. I don't know, for some reason.
That's so stupid.
It's so stupid, but I enjoyed it. And, you know, every time The Rock was hanging off the side of the building, I had a good time. I love the whole crane scene. I thought the crane scene was really fun. And the plot is preposterously stupid. I mean, like, ridiculous. And you're right about people standing on the street watching it on the giant screen. The subplot involving the Hong Kong detectives trying to figure out the mystery,
idiots,
is hilarious. I don't know. This is a really dumb movie. There's no question about it, but I'm not going to say I wasn't entertained, and I thought it was fun. I had a good time watching it. None of the stuff in the House of Mirrors and the Pearl thing makes any sense at all, but I didn't care. I thought it was fun. The villains are unmemorable. To say that it's a carbon copy of a carbon copy of a carbon copy of Die Hard is to give it a compliment. But for some reason, I don't know why, for some reason, I had a fun time watching this movie. I did. And I'd be the first to acknowledge, and you know what? Everything that you guys said in terms of what your criticisms were about the movie, I absolutely can see and I understand. But for some reason, this appealed to me. But I will say this: my dad hated it. My dad said that was the stupidest movie I have ever seen in my life. My dad said that like right after the movie, and my mom and I both had fun, and we were like, "Why don't you lighten up?" And he's like, "No, that was stupid." And then he kept pointing out the stupidity. He's like, "What about the time when he did?" And I go, "I know, Dad. That's unbelievable." He just he couldn't believe that my mom and I enjoyed the movie because he thought it was the stupidest, most unrealistic thing that he'd ever seen in his life. And on some level, he's right. So
I just hope that Dwayne Johnson got paid in advance for the inevitable Hong Kong vodka and duct tape commercials that are going to result from this movie.
Oh, it's an absolute salute to duct tape. I mean, yes. it's the most duct taped ever used in a movie, and to so many different extents.
Yep.
I mean, no, it's a 90-minute commercial for duct tape. Anyway, I enjoyed it. All right. Next week, we've got a lot of movies to talk about next week. There's Blindspotting, Gus Van Zandt's newest one. Don't worry, he won't get far on foot. There's Eighth Grade, Equalizer 2, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, which I'm telling you now I'm not seeing.
Nick.
Unfriended Dark Web. So lots of stuff to talk about. All right. Colin, thanks, man.
All right.
And we will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right. And Eric, you hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There you go. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got the box office to talk about. And we do that every week with Eric. So that's coming up right after we take this break. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here, 18 floors above the lovely city of Chicago, Illinois. Well, we reviewed all the new movies for this week, as we do every week. And now we're going to talk about the box office. Eric Childress writes about it, and we talk about it every week. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, so let's go through this. Number one this week, Hotel Transylvania 3, Summer Vacation, $44.1 million, $45.3 total. And that's pretty solid, right? How does that compare to the other ones?
It's right in the middle. It did better than the original film, not quite as much as the second film, but you know, people need to remember that those movies opened in September.
Right.
So there wasn't a lot of competition for the family audiences when they opened. This one in the middle of summer, so some might think that that might boost the total a little bit. But there's there is still a lot of family options out there. I mean, Incredibles 2 is still out there. Ant-Man is certainly family worthy.
Yeah.
And you could even throw Jurassic World in there as well. But if that's a very solid number, and this is a franchise series now that's now going to pass $1 billion. Because of this movie, and it's probably going to end up about 150, 160 million here in the U.S. So this is a very solid number for
them. And also, I mean, the reason I think the reason why they released this during the summer is because it's about summer.
Yes,
because it's about a summer vacation. So that's why instead of it being like a late September sort of Halloween-y release, that's why it's released here in July, because that's what the movie's about. It's about a summer vacation.
That's right.
So, all right. Well, that's pretty solid numbers for that, which would probably guarantee that they'll make another one. I mean,
probably.
Yeah. Okay. Number two, Ant-Man and the Wasp, $28.8 million, $132.8 million total. How's that doing comparatively?
It's doing fine. It had quite a big drop this week, 62% drop, which is a little heavier than I thought it might do. But it's done $132 million. It's approaching $300 million worldwide. It's doing very well overseas, internationally as well. This one is still hoping to hit the $200 million mark.
Okay. All right. And then number three, we were just talking about it, Skyscraper. My dad, according to my dad, the stupidest movie ever made. $25.4 million over the weekend. That's not great, right?
It's not great, no. And, it was actually, it could have been worse. There were the projections this weekend were actually much lower. They were closer to 20.
Really?
So it was kind of like Rampage. They went low end, and then it kind of boosted this total throughout the week throughout the weekend. But that's not a number, in the States that Universal is going to be happy with, but it probably doesn't matter because given Johnson's success overseas with the last few films, Jumanji and Rampage did really well overseas. And considering this movie's set in Hong Kong,
right.
The money in China is going to be pretty prolific here. So Universal will go Dwayne Johnson might want to look at his if Rob Reiner needs writers, I think Dwayne Johnson needs directors.
Yeah,
it'd be nice to see him work with some name talent.
Yeah, it's an action movie from the director of We're the Millers.
That's right. That's right.
By the way, though, I do want to mention this movie was shot by Robert Elswit. Which I thought it was a really great looking movie when I saw his name on the
I didn't even notice that
it's shot by Robert Elswit, man, and like I was sitting at the end watching the credits, and his name came up, and I went, you got to be kidding me. I mean, that's why it looks so good. That's why it was a really beautiful-looking movie, but my God, I can't believe he shot that movie.
Oh, God.
Oh, man. Okay. Number four, Incredibles 2, $16.2 million. It's up just in America to $535 million.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's made another $320 in the foreign market, so it's over $850 million worldwide. This thing will eventually hit $1 billion. You know, it's going to work on trying to get up to $600 million. Here in the States. Yeah. Again, I mean, not to say it, but it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, no, I know. That's the word for it. There's no question about it. Number five, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, $15.5 million, $363 million total, which is considerable drop from the last one, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the last one did over $600 million. It came out of nowhere, but it was unprecedented. People thought the success of that movie. But this one, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, it's still on a pace that it's going to become Universal's second highest grossing film of all time.
Wow.
After the first Jurassic World.
Wow.
As far as in the States, at least.
Yeah, it's still amazing to me the numbers that Jurassic World did. I just, you know, every time we talk about it, I'm like, how?
Yeah. And this one's no slouch either. I mean, the numbers are down in America, but $1.13 billion worldwide.
Yeah. Okay. All right. People like dinosaurs.
They do.
Number six is The First Purge, $9.1 million, $49 million so far. But what did it cost? $2?
Yeah, actually, it's the most expensive movie of the series. It cost a whole $13 million.
Look at that, man.
Yeah.
And they'll just keep making them. They don't have to, you know what I mean? I mean,
oh, yeah. What does it doesn't matter. You just turn out whatever junk you want as long as you can turn a profit. And until the grosses are down, they'll keep making them. So why not?
Okay. Number seven, Sorry to Bother You, $4.2 million up to $5.3 million. But those are big numbers because it's in limited release.
They boosted the screen total up to 800 theaters.
Oh, okay.
And I don't think it's quite the number that they were hoping for. I think they were really thinking with the numbers last week and the critical response to it that it was really going to, you know, become this little, like Big Sick type numbers. And these really aren't Big Sick, at least not yet. We'll see, you know, how if they continue to expand this thing. But I think the indie sensation that's on the way is Eighth Grade.
Okay.
I think that movie, you know, was only in four theaters this week and had the highest per theater average of the year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it bested Isle of Dogs with a 63,000 per screen average. So I think that if A24 plays their cards right in that expansion, I think that's the film that you're going to see people start flocking to.
Yeah, and we get that one next week, right?
That's right.
Okay. And then number eight is Sicario: Day of the Soldada. $3.8 million, $43.2 million. That's less than the first one, right?
Yeah, but just under. I mean, the first one did $46 million, so it's kind of right on par with that first one. It's still only done a little under $16 million internationally, so it's overall it's less than the original. Which again, like, why? Why did this get made?
Yeah. Okay. Number nine, Uncle Drew, $3.2 million, $36.6 million total.
Yeah, so again, a small budgeted film, it's $38 million. It's going to be right on the cusp of breaking even and possibly turning a profit.
Okay, and then number 10, Ocean's 8, $2.9 million. It's up to $132.2 million. That's not bad.
No. I mean, it was $70 million production, so not a huge cost for a movie of this type. It's made $251 million worldwide, so it's already gotten itself into profit.
Okay. All right, so what are we looking at next week? Is Denzel going to top it, you think?
I'm wondering how people are going to flock to Equalizer next week, if that's going to be that's going to have enough in the tank to best Hotel Transylvania. No, as a matter of fact, I think Mamma Mia takes number one next weekend.
You think Mamma Mia, really?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yeah, whether Equalizer gets up to number two or not, I'm gonna say Mamma Mia, Hotel Transylvania, Equalizer.
Okay. Well, I want to watch Denzel Washington beat the crap out of people. That's
well, who doesn't?
I mean, that's, you know, it's going to be 2 hours of Denzel Washington beating the crap out of people, and I'm totally fine with that. All right. Well, that's what we'll look forward to next week. We'll do it all over again. And Eric, thanks, man.
Sure thing.
All right, take care. There you go. There's Eric Childress, everybody. And we'll do it again next week. Review all the new movies. And, of course, we will talk about box office as well. All right, we're going to take a break. We got the news coming up next right here on 720 WGN.